Hello and welcome to Woman Inherits the Earth, a mother-daughter podcast about the representation of women in movies and television. I am Tessa Dare, a writer and the author of the paranormal mystery series The Karanzen Chronicles and Beth's daughter.
And I am Beth Von Baron, Tessa's mother and also a writer. Today, we are discussing Anatomy of a Fall, Anatomie d'une Chute, that's the French version.
All right.
It is mostly in, well, it's in French and English. There's not actually a lot of German in it, even though the main character is a native German speaker. So there's a lot of subtitles in it. It's from Neon Pictures, with what looks like funding from France TV and Cinema. The running hour is 2 hours and 31 minutes. Directed by Justine Triet, or Triet probably. Written by Justine Triet and Arthur Harari. This film was the winner of the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and that is the highest prize awarded to the films that are nominated. And it looks like there's about 10 each year that are nominated, maybe a little bit more. There's quite a list, actually. I was looking at it earlier. It has been nominated in this country for Best Director and Best Picture at the 2024 Academy Awards. Stars Sandra Huller, or Huller, not sure, probably Huller, I would think.
I would think.
It's a U with two dots over it. Yeah, yeah. As Sandra. Swan Erlaud as Vincent, the lawyer, and Milo Mikado Grainer as Daniel. Those are the three main characters, a lot of supporting characters.
And Daniel is a child.
Daniel is a child. And that is, I can read the IMDb description. The story begins when Samuel is found dead in the snow outside the isolated chalet where he lives with his wife, Sandra, a German writer, and their partially sighted 11-year-old son, Daniel. An investigation leads to a conclusion of suspicious death. It's impossible to know for sure whether he took his own life or was killed. Sandra is indicted, and we follow her trial, which pulls the couple's relationship apart. Daniel, the child, is caught in the middle between the trial and their home life. Doubts take their toll on the mother-son relationship.
Yeah, I think that is roughly an accurate description, although technically the story actually begins earlier than that. It begins with Sandra being interviewed by, I think, one of her students. While she's trying to conduct this interview, her husband, Samuel, I guess the French pronunciation is more like Samuel. Anyway, he while they're trying to do the interview, he starts blasting music from the third floor of their chalet, eventually making it impossible for them to continue, which clearly irritates Sandra and honestly also the woman who drove all the way out there to interview her. But they part ways and agree to finish later on. And then their Sandra and Samuel's son Daniel goes on a walk with his dog. And when he comes back, he finds his dad's body in the snow.
So there are two things about this opening scene. I was actually a little astounded that Sandra wasn't more upset about him running this very loud, chaotic, almost punk-sounding, grating, noisy music.
There's a term for it. It's like that sort of tin drum that you hear sometimes in, like, Caribbean music.
Yeah, it's called, the music, the song is called Pimp.
Yes.
And yeah, so that's one thing that bothers me, that it's very loud. I mean, it's oppressively loud.
It's
We can barely hear the conversation between the two women.
Yeah.
And he's up two floors. He's up two floors from her, and it's that loud.
It's obnoxious, and it does kind of immediately raise the question of why doesn't she go and ask him to turn it down? Spoilers for later. My suspicion now, having seen the whole thing, is that she felt like he was probably in a really sensitive place and maybe didn't want to inflame that you know, they had just had a fight the day before that was pretty nasty, and I'm guessing either she just didn't want to interact with him because of that fight, or she, you know, she felt like maybe she had to walk on eggshells.
She's very accepting of his need to have this music played so loud. She even mentions to her, I told you it might be loud.
Yeah,
she says that to her. So she knew that this was a possibility, and she went ahead and scheduled the interview Anyway, so the whole thing is a little bit odd. We don't know why yet. We come to understand why later, but at this moment, it's an odd opening. And I would say that it wasn't apparent to me in for the first 10 or 15 minutes that Daniel was blind. And not severely, he can see a little bit, but it wasn't obvious to me until he's explaining how he had to touch the textured stuff that his dad had put on the building
Yeah, the tape.
to the tape. To know where he was, and it had different textures.
They do eventually reveal that Daniel's father put tape around the house with different textures so that Daniel would always know where he was, which becomes important when he is later. They keep referring to him as a witness to what happened, and I guess in a way he is, but he didn't actually witness his father's death. He was more just like the only person other than the person who was suspected of killing him who was in the vicinity, but he didn't see his father's death. He didn't even, by his own account, he didn't witness an argument. He doesn't think that they were arguing before it happened. There's kind of one big scene that is at the center of this where we finally get some insight into their relationship, but before that, there's like an hour at the beginning of this movie where you don't really know anything about the deceased person, Samuel, except that he interrupted his wife's interview with this loud music. You don't even see him because she doesn't go up and interrupt him. You just hear the music turn on, and then eventually you hear really loud power tools turning on, and then you see him dead. So there's just this
And that's
whole.
weird too. The power tools is weird. It's like, where is this in the music? What's going on here? And actually, we don't see him until he's dead in the snow.
But it is, we do eventually find out that he was doing work on the chalet because they wanted to turn it into a bed and breakfast. For about an hour of this movie, you don't really know anything about him. You don't really see him on screen. You don't hear him speak. You just know that he did that, and that's it. And then he's dead. I mean, I think the whole movie is going for a very kind of cinema verite style. No one is really wearing makeup, or no one is made up to look glamorous. They're using mostly natural lighting, and the cinematography style for me seems to echo kind of documentary filmmaking more than most cinematic filmmaking styles. It's a lot of like shaky cam. There's actually one point in the court proceedings where the camera slowly follows the judge walk to a chamber and then it holds on her for a second and then the camera suddenly jumps back to where she had been and then back. And I'm not totally sure why that shot is in there, but my best guess is it's another way of going for a kind of documentary style filmmaking, because all it does really is call attention to the fact that someone is recording this, because it seems like a mistake. It seems like a mistake that someone made while they were recording it, but it's in the final product. So I feel like that is part of this sort of cinema verite. Though, to be clear, they're not doing a full-on mockumentary. They're not acting like this is a fictional documentary. It's more just the style.
I don't get the feel of it as a documentary at all.
That's the only way I can explain that choice.
Well, and that particular choice, There's a lot of up close up of faces and conversations. So I don't get that sense of it that it's, a documentary style. And I also did not have the problem that you had, and we discussed this just a little
To
bit.
be clear, I just mean in the cinematography. I don't think it's trying to be a fake documentary. I mean, the cinematography feels more like documentary style filmmaking than cinematic.
Well, it could be French style too. I don't know anything about French film. So I know I understand what you're saying, but I was not bothered by the first hour of it. I do think the film is too long. It's 2 hours and 31 minutes long. And your initial comments to me yesterday were that the first hour was just
Yeah, it felt like a boring episode of Law and Order.
Law and Order. That's it. So I watch a lot more detective TV shows than you do. So I actually found the buildup here to be interesting because they were piecemealing the story. They're piecing the story together. I think the movie's too long. I'm not sure where they would cut it, but I did see. Feel that they were piecing the story together from the. I mean, when Daniel, not Daniel, when Sam, Samuel, when Samuel is killed, when he's found dead, there's only two people in the vicinity. There are no tracks around the house that would have showed an intruder. Obviously, the mostly blind son has not killed his father. He can barely walk into the house without touching the wall. How would he do that? Although later on, he does. go up to the attic where his father had been working, which is a very scary scene for me.
I don't think he has any trouble getting around, because he was going on a hike in the mountain, but he is 11 years old. He's not physically big enough to have killed his father.
That's why I did not understand that he was blind. Before we find that his father is dead in the snow, Daniel is off walking with his dog Snoop, by the way.
Yes.
And they are walking in, and there had been reference in the interview, in the opening interview, about her son's accident, which we find out about later on. But when they cut away from the house in the interview, and Daniel is walking around in the snow that isn't very deep, but there is snow on the ground, and they are on a hill, he and the dog. He's struggling to keep the dog under control. And then you see a river and a bridge. And my immediate thought is, because again, I couldn't remember what the story was about. My immediate thought is, oh my God, he's going to go into the frozen river here. And at this point, even having with that fear, I still had not realized that he was blind.
Mm.
So this is a very slow buildup. I think you're right. That whole scene probably could have been cut. But so he comes back and he finds his father dead. It's then that we realize that he's blind, or we find out that he's blind, and his mother is the only other person in the house. So the immediate attention for the investigation falls on her. That's just the point that I'm trying to get to. And that does take a long time. And the other thing about this is the whole way they investigate it. On one hand, the investigation seems to be a little bit more sensitive than the way American murder investigations are portrayed on television, which tend to be rougher and bloodier. And this is a very sensitive approach in some ways.
In some ways.
But then when you get to the trial, it's completely reversed.
Yeah.
And in American trials, you cannot do what they do in this trial.
Yeah, they do a lot of, yeah.
A lot of opinionating, a lot of slanderous stuff that would be just cut, you know, stopped immediately in an American courtroom, which I think is the way you should go.
I do think it is, there is an interesting element to this experience being an American watching this, because I don't really know how the French courts work, but mm-hmm. it felt to me like there were a number of moments that would not have flown in an American court, including the fact that this went to trial at all, because they have literally no evidence. They have no evidence that it was her.
No evidence and no motive. In the American court system, you have to have three things: evidence, motive, and means.
Yeah.
So they can't prove the means either, because she's asleep.
Yeah.
When this happens to him.
And they don't have a murder weapon.
They don't have a murder weapon. That's a third one. Not it's motive, murder weapon, and I think that is the means.
I think that's the means, and, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so they don't have a murder weapon, and he has a big gash on his head.
Yeah.
And it's a little confusing, but sometimes they say, well, he was hit over the head and knocked out the window, and other times they say, oh no, he hit his head when he hit the shed.
Yeah, they're kind of inconsistent about that.
Very, very inconsistent.
When she is first talking to her lawyer about it, he says, you know, the most obvious thing to conclude is that he must have hit his head on the shed on the way down. However, there's no blood on the shed, so we're just not going to go with that at all. But then later, when they're doing the, like, blood spatter analysis in the courtroom, both sides say, like, show that he must have hit his head on the shed on the way down. So I'm just like, why are we here?
But there is blood on the shed. There is blood on the shed.
But it's not on top of the shed.
No, it's on the side, yeah. Which is a little odd.
Just to be clear to the listeners, in case you haven't watched the film, the only reason that they determined that there is a suspicious cause to this death, and the only reason that they do that is because he has a gash on his head that they decide is inconsistent with the position in which his body was found, which right off the bat, I'm just like, I'm sorry, you don't think there's any possibility that his body fell one way first and then moved? But they're on a snowy slope. You don't think there's any chance that his body just yes. isn't in the exact position that it initially fell in, like that
could have rolled, or
yeah.
he could have been still alive and yeah. crawled, and that's what the conclusion they come to is that he crawled a little bit,
yeah,
and turned his body over,
yeah. So I did find watching about the first hour of this movie to be kind of frustrating for two reasons. One, because it felt like so much of it was designed to give me little context-free snippets as if to be constantly reminding me that I don't know for sure what's going on. And my feeling is you don't need to do any of that. I already know that I don't know what's going on. You could kind of jump straight to the trial and I would still know that I don't know exactly what's going on. And then the other side to it is I did not feel at any point that there was a compelling reason to indict her at all.
And let's get to that, because there is no motive. Mm-hmm. We find out during the course of the trial that they have recordings that he had been making for the last year of his life in secret that she knew nothing about.
Yeah.
And some of them have fights in them. Well, every couple fights.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's not enough of a motive. But they also used that as proof somehow. He was recording his life. He was feeling good about himself as proof that he was not suicidal.
Yes, people who are feeling good about themselves record their spouse in secret.
Thank you. and there's no weapon. The thing is, they were on a snowy hilltop.
Yeah.
If she had clubbed him over the head with something, there would have been a weapon that they could find.
Exactly.
Not that much time had gone by. She wouldn't have been able to go out into the woods and hide the weapon and then come back and not leave footprints in the snow.
Or have her son not noticed that that happened. Like, her son finds him pretty soon and she comes down, like, he calls for her and she comes down from, like, deep in the house. They dismiss it very quickly at trial. The prosecutor is like, we all know it's easy to get rid of a weapon. And I'm just like, I'm sorry,
really?
Do we all know that?
No, it's really not.
So that is, I mean, again, it's one of those things where I just kept having to remind myself, okay, this is France. And maybe their court system is really different. Now, to be fair, in the American court system, I would basically only believe that this went to trial if Samuel had been really rich and she really wasn't. Because that's typically how court justice happens in America. Whoever's wealthy is the one who has the advantage in the court of law, as it were. But that brings us back to motive. She has no financial motive to kill him. Like, the chalet,
she's the breadwinner. She's the breadwinner.
Yeah, but she's the primary breadwinner, at least from what we can tell. It seems like her work is what brings them the most money. The chalet was his family's, but also she doesn't seem to like living there. I don't think she wants the chalet. I don't think she would kill him for the chalet. This is a very classic example of a divorce would be easier than killing him.
Yeah.
And their kid is 11, which, you know, that's how old I was when my parents got divorced. You're old enough to deal with it at that point.
Well, I think divorce never occurs to her because she does not understand how truly mentally ill he is. Or I started to say unhappy, but it's not just that he's unhappy. There's something else much more serious going on, and he has hidden it from her. She doesn't understand.
Yeah, I think despite his characterization of her in the fight, which we should probably get to pretty soon, I think despite his characterization of her, she has actually really given him the benefit of the doubt over and over again and really tried to make this work.
She really has. She moved... She was happy in London.
She was happy in London. She moved here for him.
She didn't
want
to move to France.
Yeah.
She moved there for him. She put her whole life on hold for him. And we'll get to the conversation between them in a minute. But she's not incredibly unhappy because she loves her son.
She loves their son. She loves her husband.
Yeah, I think she does too. She appreciates him and she loves him.
Yeah.
She would love to go back to London, but they're there so that he can write. And here's something else about the beginning of the film before we get into the crux of the film, which is their fight. There's a statement in the interview. I'm not sure if Sandra makes it or the young woman who's interviewing her. But it's a statement that basically says, you're mixing truth and fiction, which is which. That's a theme in this movie. And it's introduced very early on, truth versus fiction.
Yeah.
The husband has his truth and his fiction that he gives her because he doesn't tell her he's recording all their conversations. That's basically that. I think we need to move on and talk about, it's not even a turning point. It's the main
the kind of the heart of the film. Yeah.
The heart of the film. And it does take us a long time to get there.
It does take us a while. Yeah.
And it takes us an hour and a half.
Yeah.
To get to, to get to the conversation or the fight between them. And to find out at that point that it has been recorded. And I just want to also say here that the man who is introducing the recording, who is some kind of investigator, has imbued it with his opinions.
Oh, yeah.
About how it's all, she's the bad guy. Mm-hmm. But if you listen to, and we'll get into what they're talking about, but if you listen to it, she's almost all the way to the very last minute of their fight, when it actually becomes a fight, it becomes a little violent. Until that point, she is still supportive of him and understanding of him. He is the one accusing her of doing terrible things to him that have no substance.
So yeah, it takes us an hour and a half to get there. It takes us an hour to get to the court case and then another half an hour to get to the reveal of this recording, which is basically the most real insight that we get into what their marriage was like. And I think they did a really good job of writing this scene in such a way that I would absolutely believe that a lot of men would take his side, and also that they are wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Because I really do believe, and it's subtle.
Yeah.
It's subtle. But when you, and the thing is, if you were just hearing him in a lot of the conversation that's been recorded, if we weren't also, as the omniscient movie viewers, seeing the scene happening, because they're playing the audio in the courtroom, but we are seeing it happening because we're in the film audience
until the end,
and until the most important part of their fight we don't get to see. So but leading up to that, we see him, and when he makes these accusations about her, he gets this look on his face like, I got you.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knows he's recording her.
Exactly. Even without the physicality of it, if you just listen to the things that he says, everything he says is designed to be a trap. And when she counters him with logic, he pivots to a different emotional trap. It is sublimely frustrating to listen to, because he makes no decent points, and yet you can just see men all over the world being like, look at this poor put-upon man, and it just makes me want to tear my hair out.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that whole truth and fiction thing, he is saying these things that never seem real or true to me when he's speaking them. But everything Sandra says in response, in her defense, in her assessment of her husband and their relationship, which is what this conversation is about, in her understanding of the psychiatrist's bias against her, and we'll talk about that later on. Oh my God,
yeah, we should.
And her empathy for her son. All of these things ring so true from the very beginning. I never doubt her. Neither did I. And I don't know what it is, if it's the acting, if it's the writing, if it's directing, but that is so very convincing to me throughout the film.
I feel like it's because you and I can recognize the situation that's happening, you know?
Maybe that's it.
But and I don't think it's just that. I also think that they have done a very good job of playing to these kind of sexist tropes that a lot of men still really believe in. She is a powerful woman who is more successful in the field that this man wants to be successful in, and I would say the majority of people have an innate suspicion of successful women, and that alone is basically what propels you, because I will say, like, I did not forget what this film was supposed to be about. I had seen it described repeatedly as a courtroom thriller where you don't know whether or not she did it until the very end, and then I started watching it and I was like, I'm sorry, who watches this and thinks she did it? There's no evidence. Like, unless you are just going into it innately suspicious of her, there is no point in this movie where I truly thought she did it. At most, before the court case started, there was a moment where I was like, we can't really prove one way or the other. That's the closest I got to thinking she might have done it.
You know, in this kind of, you can't convict somebody. All you have to do to get somebody off of a murder charge is to have reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of doubt in this film.
Yeah.
The first half of the film, they completely rule out that it's suicide because they don't understand what this man was going through.
Yeah.
And they don't make any attempt to. They talk to his psychiatrist, but he's got his psychiatrist bamboozled.
Yeah, exactly. He is absolutely the kind of psychiatrist who just takes what their patients say at face value and does not actually hold up a mirror to them, does not hold them responsible, does not make them engage with their own behaviors. And like, that is a thing. There are a lot of psychiatrists out there who will just sort of passively listen, and that's not really what your therapist is supposed to do.
No, they're supposed to help you question what you're doing and understand it. And this man, this psychiatrist, never does this with this man. We'll come back to that later because she really stands up to him.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of this movie. She has to stand up to three or four men mm-hmm. who have completely convinced themselves and everybody around them that this terrible woman has killed her husband. Mm-hmm. And she stands up and defends herself so gently, yet forcibly, so eloquently.
Yeah.
And it's so righteously.
Yeah.
And in a good kind of righteousness. And it's calm. She's reserved. She doesn't screech. She doesn't scream. She's mm-hmm. not the screaming female. Mm-hmm. She is reserved. She's got that Germanic reserve going on.
Yes.
And it really serves her well. And I'm not sure how the court system is set up here. There's like a judge, but then it seems like there are judges around her and that's the jury. I'm not really sure how that works. I should have looked it up. But they all listen when she speaks. And she's formidable.
So eventually they play the recording of the argument. So we see most of it happen. And then at the very end, it cuts back to the court. So the one part that would be clearly damning one way or another, we don't actually see exactly what happened. Basically, at the end of the recording, there's some sounds of violence. And just from the audio alone, I think it's truly impossible to say what has happened because they both sound distressed and there's sounds of slapping. And I'm sorry, you can't tell who is doing the slapping from a recording alone, despite what that investigator who presents it thinks, because he thinks that he knows exactly what happened. He doesn't know.
He doesn't know. And there are things breaking in it too. You can hear a couple things breaking. And she does stand up at the end and explain exactly everything you hear in that part. She remembers it clearly.
And I think her explanation is quite credible.
Everything she says is credible.
Yeah. I didn't exactly write down how the conversation goes, but I did write my notes in the form of an outline for an essay on why Samuel is wrong.
We shouldn't be laughing because this is very serious.
It is serious, and he is dead. And I don't not have some empathy for him because he seems like he was a very tortured soul, but where my empathy ends is where he decides that this is all his wife's fault when in fact pretty much everything he complains about is his own doing.
And not only that, but and they don't ever state this, and maybe it's just implied, maybe it isn't even implied, maybe it's just my interpretation, but it feels to me like he killed himself in such a way as to set her up to take the fall. Just got the meaning of the title.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They never conclude that he intentionally set her up. So my sort of journey through the film was, at the beginning, I honestly thought it was probably an accident, that he probably just fell out accidentally and it was kind of unfortunate.
Yes, I agree.
And, you know, and the way a lot of these accidents go is sometimes it's hard to tell exactly what happened. And then by the end, I am pretty convinced that he killed himself. And my conspiracy theory brain is he killed himself and intentionally set her up to take the fall. Which, by the way, by the time he's dead, she is the only parent left to their son. So that's kind of a double asshole move. If she had been convicted...
It's a male asshole move.
It's a variation on men who kill their families before killing themselves. Because he wouldn't just be ruining her life, he'd be ruining the son's life. Now, to be fair, the film does not say that that's what he did.
Never.
But he did leave this recording there. And
lots of recordings.
Yeah, he left all of these secret recordings. It feels like, at the very least, that was subconsciously what he was doing. So during the argument, and actually I think this gets revealed a little bit earlier, we find out that Samuel is partially responsible for their son's disability.
He's responsible in the sense that he made a promise to do his fair share in childcare and did not do it.
Yeah, he was supposed to go and pick Samuel up from, or sorry, Daniel up from school, and then he got caught up in writing and instead called their babysitter, who arrived to get him late, and maybe they were rushing, unclear, but after she arrived to pick up Daniel, he was hit by a motorcyclist, and the accident damaged his optic nerve, and that is why he is now partially blind. But basically, it's not that Samuel did something actively to hurt Daniel, but he did fail in his parental duty to show up for him, and that, unfortunately, ended in this accident. And they do make a point to say that Samuel felt very guilty about this.
He blames himself, but interestingly, Sandra never blames him.
Yeah, she doesn't. She does not.
She understands that he feels the blame, but she also has, and I don't want to say it's a fatalistic approach to life, but an acceptance. She understands that the accidents happen.
Yeah.
Things happen. She does not want her child to feel even more disabled than he is. She doesn't want him to see himself as a disabled
person. Yeah, she says she doesn't want to cast his accident as a tragedy or obsess over it as a tragedy because this is the only life he has and she wants him to live it to its fullest. Which I feel like as soon as she said that, even everything else, I'm like, I'm completely on her side. Like, it's kind of rare that you see a parent with a disabled child in a film who actually has a decent philosophy about it. Like, so much of the time,
it's hard to do.
It is hard. But, like, you can tell that she has done the internal work to deal with whatever her own feelings might be and is prioritizing Daniel being able to live his life, which brings us to a really important point and in some ways the weird arbitrary center of this argument. For whatever reason, Samuel decided that he was going to homeschool Daniel for most of the week, like 3 days a week. They do say that Daniel goes to school in town 2 days a week, and Sandra brings him to school one of those days, and their family friend slash occasional babysitter brings him the other day. And then the other 3 days, Samuel homeschools him, which I have a number of issues with. Personally, I am not a big fan of homeschooling. In America, homeschooling is very much associated with religious zealotry. But I also just think that that's a huge task to take on yourself. And I feel like it's very...
Especially for a child who is blind.
Exactly. And the thing is, it feels like... and that's the other side to it. It feels like he's doing it because his kid... I mean, obviously he's doing it because his kid is blind, both for his guilt, but I think also because... It's like he feels like Daniel is not up for being in school 5 days a week. And I just don't think that's correct. I think Daniel would do just fine in school.
And schools, modern schools, are set up to work with children who have especially in France. But here's my theory about it. I think he does this because he needs an excuse for sabotaging his own professional goals.
Absolutely.
He sees himself as a writer, but he never writes. Mm-hmm. He cannot write. He interviews people. He records things. He cannot write a single word. He does come up with an idea at one point, and he doesn't do anything with it, and it's a great idea. And she asks him, I could write a novel. I could write something with that idea. May I borrow it? May I steal it? May I have it? And he gives it to her because he can't do anything with this idea. She makes it into a novel that sells and supports them. But so he needs an excuse to not write. And what better excuse than to teach the child that you feel like you blinded?
So I have a lot of issues with him deciding to homeschool the kid. And then my final issue with it is that is clearly what is taking up most of his time. But the crux of this argument that they play is his complaining that he feels like Sandra doesn't do her fair share of their shared work when, like, the main thing that is taking up his time is this homeschooling task that he wanted to do that she told him was not a good idea.
The other thing that takes up his time is the work on the house.
Yes, which he also decided to do.
It was his decision, yes.
So this is kind of like their whole argument, is he is pissed. Well, first of all, you know, we come in kind of in media res into this argument, but it sounds like the very beginning of the argument is he's annoyed that she's going to do either the interview that the movie began with or interviews in general. A new book of hers has just come out and she needs to do a tour, some amount of tour. We're not really sure if it's, you know, a big traveling tour, if it's just doing a bunch of interviews, but he's upset that this is happening. You can kind of tell because they're sitting there eating that she doesn't realize that he's about to, like, gale force tornado fight her. She just thinks that they're kind of having a normal conversation. So she's just kind of like, well, you know this. It's just the time. Like, this is just what I have to do after the book comes out. And his response is, it's always just this time, but it's your time. It's not my time. And he just kind of, like, explodes at her. So his initial annoyance is just a normal part of having a job as a writer, which is her job. That's his initial annoyance. And then he builds into, you know that you can only have this career because I do way more of the work at home and that allows it for you. And I'm saying that I want this to be flipped. And then she says, okay, but what are the things that you're talking about? And he basically does admit that the things that take up his time are taking care of Daniel and working on the house.
Yep.
Which she says, these are both projects that you wanted to take on that I told you would get in the way of your writing time. And now he's mad that he doesn't have enough time to write. It's infuriating. But he keeps just ignoring all of her arguments. His take on it is that she, quote unquote, imposes her style of doing things on the family. And he has two main points here. The first is that she, quote unquote, imposes her language, which I didn't even need to hear her response to know how bullshit that was. So he says she imposes her language because she speaks English. She is not English. She is German. They both speak English. He's annoyed that she won't speak French, which would be her third language, not her second language. It sounds like, based on the fact that they lived in London before, it sounds like they met in England. I'm not 100% sure about that, but it sounds like they met in England.
They agreed on this. They agreed that they came to this country, which is his country, that they would continue to speak English because they both can speak that language. She can speak a little bit of French, but she struggles with it.
Yeah, she's not as fluent in it as she is in English or German. And he is pissed that she won't speak his native language. And she rightfully points out, you don't speak mine either. English is not my native language. It's the meeting ground between the two. And then his frickin' response is, but we're in France. Yeah, she moved to France for you. I just, like, the more things that he says, the more clear it is that actually she has made a lot more concessions for him than he has made for her. She moved to France for him. She did not want to.
Absolutely. She lives in his country. She never wanted to move there. Mm-hmm. She did it because she loved him, but it's not enough for him. He wants her to give up huge portions of her life so he can pretend to write.
Yes.
He says to her, you really have no shame. He says this to her.
Yes, he says
you really
this to her,
have no shame. That's your superpower. It allows you to see no one but yourself. And she responds to him still very calmly. I see you very clearly. I just don't see you as a victim.
Mm-hmm,
and that's a
he's
huge
not.
Part. He's not. And that's a huge part of this discussion.
Yeah.
He keeps saying, but me, this is what you're doing to me. This is what you're doing to me. And she's like, no, you're doing that to yourself. You are not a victim. I'm not doing this to you. These are your choices.
Yeah. Yeah, at one point he says, we're on your turf all the time. And she responds, we are in your country.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. So his main other big point in this fight that she never had sex the way that he wanted to.
The way he wanted it. Oh,
and
my God.
Her facial expression when he says this, just the kind of like out of nowhere shock. She's just like, what the fuck?
What are you talking about?
And she responds with, let's be honest, who's been refusing to fuck since the accident? And his response to that is, you know damn well I meant before. So I'm just going to pause here and say, okay, so they do reveal that they have not had sex since Daniel's accident. Daniel was 4 when that accident happened. He is now 11. This man has refused to have sex with her for 7 years. And she is still with him. And not only that, but he doesn't think that that is the sex life problem that they need to talk about. What they need to talk about is 7 years ago, she didn't do what he wanted sexually. And when she asks him what he means, his response is, quote unquote, everything, which is exactly what you would say if you didn't have an actual answer and just wanted to make her feel as bad as possible. It's just the epitome of fighting emotionally with no logic. Because he has no answer. This is just a thing that he's made up to try to make her feel bad.
You know, I will insert something here, devil's advocate, that did occur to me. She does have affairs a couple of times. She doesn't have affairs, I should say. She has sexual liaisons a couple of times during the course, I think once before the accident, and then maybe once or twice in the 7 years after the accident.
I don't know if she said that she did it before, but she did say that right after the accident.
I thought she said she did. Maybe it was right after.
Right after the accident, she had a couple and she told him about them.
She did. She's been very honest with him. It's like he's not, upset about it until he starts talking about it. And
Uh-huh.
then the more he talks about it, the more upset he gets. And she explains to him, and they've apparently talked about this before. She says to him, sex is just a form of personal hygiene.
Yeah.
And he is refusing to let her take care of herself by refusing to have sex with her. But he feels that it's all her fault. She says, I refuse to rot inside,
Yeah.
so I find solutions. And at this point, sex was just a question of personal hygiene.
Yeah.
So she has physical needs that she is meeting, interestingly, with women. They try to portray her as bisexual, and as if that's a big thing for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, they use that we learn that she's bisexual during the beginning of the trial, which is clearly a ploy by the prosecutor to label her as a sex-crazed maniac.
And he responds to her, you impose solutions, these sex solutions that she's talking about. You impose solutions which are solutions for you only. You don't give a shit if it hurts me and Daniel. And my first thought was, wait a minute, you've known about this. She's told you about it. Daniel doesn't know about it. How's it gonna hurt him?
Yeah.
Oh, but it's gonna hurt him when he hears it in the
In the
trial.
court, yep.
Although I don't think it really does, but the potential exists for
Yeah.
him to be hurt by hearing all these things in the trial. So the big thing here is that everything he accuses her of is a way to portray himself as a victim. And her basic argument to him is, no, you are
Yeah.
not a victim.
Yeah.
You want to be a victim, but you're not, because these are choices you've made. You've made the choice to teach Daniel rather than writing. You've made the choice to work on this house rather than writing. And you have made the choice not to have a sexual relationship with me,
Yeah.
your wife.
You know, I will say I don't think that adultery is right, but I do think, I mean, two things. First of all, if you are a person who has been cheated on, as far as I'm concerned, you have a choice. You can either leave the person who cheated on you, or you can stay with them. But if you stay with them, you have to forgive them. Just, and that's for yourself and for the sake of your relationship. Because
I don't think
it
he
is,
really cares, though. I don't think it really
yeah, I think he's
bothers
just
him.
using it. I'm just saying, like, from a philosophical point of view, if
Yeah.
you are staying with someone that you know has cheated on you, you cannot create this environment of constant hostility where you're just constantly bringing this up every time there's an argument. That's not a sustainable relationship. If you can't get
No.
over it, then you leave. And if you can get over it, then you get over it. You don't just get to keep bringing it up forever. And the other side to this is it's been 7 years since he has had sex with her. She's just supposed to be celibate forever to soothe his ego. It seems like at the very beginning she was pretty honest about it, and they do say that she had an affair like a couple of months ago that she didn't tell him about, and it seems pretty clear to me that she didn't tell him about it because a part of her could sense how sensitive he was at the moment, and she knew
She
that it
says
would hurt
that.
him. Yeah.
She said that. She
Yeah.
says that. Yeah.
So I'm not trying to be like the advocate for cheating here. But I will say, I think, you know, in a reasonable relationship between equals, if one partner is no longer interested in sex at all, I think it is a reasonable and healthy thing to do to have a conversation where you decide, okay, do we want to stay married to each other? And if so, does that marriage include me having sex with other people since you are not interested in this thing anymore and I feel like I need it to be a healthy individual? And there's nothing wrong with that.
I'm with you in that in most situations, probably 99% of the time, I think adultery is wrong. It's not just that it's morally wrong. It's the kind of wrong that, how to explain this? You've chosen to be in a marriage where it's a one-on-one situation.
Yes.
You know, if you didn't want to have that, if you wanted to have sex with more than one person, if you didn't want to be exclusive, quote unquote, that seems to be the term,
Yeah.
then you don't get married. And if you're going to get married, you give it up unless you have an agreement otherwise. Some marriages are different. Right. Some marriages are open marriages. I most of the time that's the way I feel about it, 99% of the time. But in this instance, and there are probably other films or TV shows where I've seen things like this happen, where there is a situation where one of the people is suffering with a mental health crisis that is not resolving itself, which
Yes.
is what's happening with Samuel here. So where this is happening, and he gives tacit agreement to her having sex with other people, because his tacit agreement is implied when he doesn't say, okay, I'm done, I want a divorce.
Yeah.
He knows it's happened. He accepts it. He doesn't hold it against her. Even in the scene where they're fighting about it, where he brings it up, he's not convincing that this has ever bothered him.
Yeah, it very much just seems like this is something.
Yeah.
Either this is just meant to hurt her or put her on the defensive, or this is meant to make him look good on the recording.
And exactly. That's exactly what he's doing here. Mm-hmm. So I think I don't judge her for having these sexual liaisons to meet her own emotional and psychological and mental well-being needs. This is a woman who is a writer, who is a creative person, who is a mother of a child who she is trying to raise to feel as normal as he can. Mm-hmm. And she's got this husband who has taken on these projects that have overwhelmed their lives.
Yeah.
So she is trying the best she can to stay in this marriage and parent her child and be a working professional. So these things, she needs a sexual outlet. Most adults need a sexual outlet.
Yeah.
You usually find that if you're married, in a marriage. Mm-hmm. She's not getting that here. And they both agree that he tacitly agrees that she can do this. So I'm fine with it. It does not bother me. I do not judge her. I don't hold it against her. And I think in the course of the trial, when they start off talking about this, they are kind of slut shaming her.
Yes.
But then it gets to a point where they start to understand what's going on here, especially when they hear this, the recording of this fight where he admits that they have not had sex in this long and that he has known about these relationships and stayed with her. That's the tacit agreement. That's the tacit approval.
Yeah.
So
I think that there is a difference between adultery and two people knowingly having an open relationship. Adultery implies that you are lying to your partner.
Right. Deceitful. Yeah.
Yeah. And deceitful, and also, you know, it's a betrayal of the agreement. If your agreement,
absolutely a betrayal.
Yeah. Yes. If your agreement is that you are monogamous to each other, then not doing that is a betrayal of your agreement. But if your agreement is that, say for instance, that you will be in love with only each other, but you're allowed to have sex with other people, then doing so is not a betrayal of that agreement.
Yes.
So I did have one point. You mentioned that she used this idea that he had for a book. And that is, I think they did a very good job of coming up with two things that, if you take them out of context, sound really bad. He accuses her of cheating on him, and he accuses her of stealing his book idea. He puts it as plundering.
Plundering.
Yes, out of context, those both sound really bad. But the context is he had already given up on that book idea and had given up on it for a while when she asked him if she could use that idea, and he agreed. And the thing that I think is telling here is that they don't paint that book as her big success. It is one of many books that she has written. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't dependent on that idea to succeed. She just didn't want that idea to go to waste. She thought it was a good idea. And when he wasn't going to do anything with it, she asked him if she could use it. I don't really see that as, you know, her stealing from him, because why would she need to? She was already a successful writer. She just didn't want that idea to go to waste. And she tells him in that fight, if you wanted to write your version of it, I will admit that I took the idea from you.
So her quote unquote plundering the idea for him. There, you could make the case that in the notes at the back of the book, she could have said, I want to give a big thank you to my husband who basically gave me the idea, the basic conflict in the book.
Yeah.
He gave me that idea.
Yeah.
And I really, I'm grateful to him. But she took that idea and wrote, as she says in court, she stands up and says, I took that idea and wrote 300 pages. He was going nowhere with it. And that's the difference in what they did with it. And again, he brings it up deliberately in this fight that he knows he is recording, because he wants, I think it's implied, he wants his wife to go to prison for his death. And these are two ways to do that. These are two motives. These are motives. He wants to give them the court system motives, and he gives them two. She's been unfaithful, and she plagiarized my work.
Yeah. This is actually a rare example of a writer on screen who I don't have problems with, because I feel like that is a key point. I don't want to say that ideas are a dime a dozen, but they are not the hard part of writing. The hard part of writing is writing. You might come, I mean, different writers feel differently about this, but I am the kind of writer who, during the course of, an average week, I might have 20 ideas run through my head. That doesn't mean I wrote 20 books. It super doesn't.
It's a very good point. In the novel that I wrote, the basic idea is not that complicated. Mm-hmm. And I was able to come up with that pretty easily. But the writing of 108,000 words, that's what it was. And so 108,000 words with different characters and other characters' plot lines and setting. Yeah. And, and plus mine was set during the pandemic. So there were so many, the details they have to mm-hmm. go into a novel are really the hard work of the novel.
Yes.
Now, if you come up with a very clever idea, and he did.
Yes, he did.
With a clever idea.
Yeah. It was a man's like brother. I think a man's brother was killed in an accident, and he really wonders what his life would have been like if that accident hadn't happened. And then one day he wakes up and he's experiencing two simultaneous lives, one where the accident is the center of his whole life and one where it never happened. And she changed it around to be a woman and her daughter. And
yeah, and then threw a whole lot of other stuff into it. Yeah. So my final thoughts about this scene, is that trying to make himself out to be a victim. Mm-hmm. She tells him, you choose to sit on the sidelines because you're afraid. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fear here. And that is one of the things a writer contends with, is fear of failure.
Yes.
Fear that you will write something and pour your heart into it and nobody will like it, nobody will read it, nobody will buy it. And you put your soul on the line, you open yourself up when you write a book. And he's afraid to do that.
Yeah.
She's not. She's done it many times. And she says to him, you wake up and you're 40 and you need someone to blame and you're the one to blame. And he is. And I think, I wonder too if, even though he might have been planning this suicide thing all along, I wonder if this argument with her doesn't actually
push him over the edge.
Yeah, push him over the edge. That's exactly it. Because he realizes she's right.
Yeah.
And he realizes that he is never not going to be afraid. And the one thing he wants to do is the one thing he can't do, and that is to actually write a novel. He'll do anything he can other than sit down and put his ideas into a novel and sit there and work at it day after day after day. He's afraid. And that's not going to change.
You know, I keep saying that I think men are much more likely to be on this guy's side. And I think that's true. But I also think that there is sometimes a conflation within our culture between cruelty and brutal honesty. And mm-hmm. in this fight, he kind of gives her no other choice but to be brutally honest. And yeah, if you don't have the context, or if you are in any way inclined to be more sympathetic to him, you might see her brutal honesty as cruelty, but it's not. It's just her defending herself because he gave her no other option. You know, it'd be one thing if he just, was this person who had never published a novel and was doing all these other things. There's nothing inherently wrong with the life that he has led, and she's not saying that there is, but he's turning around and saying that he's unhappy and that it's her fault. And that is an unfair allegation that she has no choice but to counter with truth. And some of that truth is painful to him. And I think it can be hard to see someone being a little bit, quote unquote, too honest and not feel that that's cruel, but he gave her no other choice. He backs her into a corner.
She's very calm when she responds to him. As she, throughout the entire conversation, and that's why I keep calling it a conversation, because it's an argument, but it doesn't become a fight until the very last minute or two. And she is very calm right up until that point. The witness who, or the investigator or whatever, who presents this recording to the courtroom, portrays her as someone who's in a state of rage in this argument. Yeah. She's not.
She's not.
Not until the very end. And even then, we're not sure that she is in a state of rage. Mm-hmm. She's frustrated with him. She slaps him.
Yeah.
She admits to that. And she starts the physical altercation, which doesn't really get very bad. I mean, he must twist her arm at some point because there's bruising on her arm. And she has slapped him. And she threw something across the room and broke it. She broke a glass.
She broke a glass and slapped him. And then he grabbed her arm. And then he started breaking picture frames. And then he started slapping himself. Now, this is her telling us this. We don't get to see this on screen. But I will say I intentionally re-listened to, I mean, I rewatched the argument a couple of times because I thought it was, you know, the crux of the film. And after having heard her explanation, I do think that it fits. I think it's credible and I think it fits. I think that is actually kind of the most likely explanation, because the thing is, while it's happening, you do hear him grunting in pain, but you also hear her, not exactly grunting, but she sounds afraid. She's kind of letting out, like, gasps and...
Yeah, if he's wrenching her arm, that could scare you.
I think she's actually afraid of what he's doing to himself. Is my interpretation of it. But they're both making sounds, and she's the one who sounds afraid, which suggests that he's the one who's doing more of the physical violence.
And yet, the investigator who brings this recording in says she is clearly in a more intense state of rage. So first of all, he is interpreting that. He's not, this is a courtroom where several times both sides say, let's stick to the facts, please. Let's not give our opinions. And yet this guy is doing just the opposite. He wants people to hear something in this recording that will convict this woman.
Yep.
And I wrote down before I knew who he was. They never say who he is. I'm like, who is this witness? So there's a lot of opinionating in this courtroom. And it just is so weird. And because we don't see that in American courtrooms. If you give an opinion like that, you know, there will be an objection made and the judge will rule. It's just not allowed. Very much sticks to the fact.
Before we get to this fight, there's like a whole chunk of the trial where the prosecutor takes fiction books that she's written and reads passages from them without context in an clearly intentional move to bias the jury against her, and the judge just lets it happen. There's no way that would have flown in an American courtroom.
And his implication, I mean, he maybe even states it, is, you know, she could write this, she could do it.
Exactly.
And she says to him, I'm a writer. I write fiction.
And her lawyer points out the passage that he's reading. The context of that is it's a side character who goes insane and also doesn't actually do the things that she's thinking about. Because it's a character thinking about killing her husband. But in the book, that character does not kill her husband. And also it's a portrait of someone going insane.
And doesn't he mention a work of fiction? I can't remember now, but it seems like he brings up a famous book and says, well, do you think the writer did this?
One of her other lawyers, because we can never go a full episode without talking about Stephen King for some reason, he says,
Stephen King.
And is Stephen King a serial killer then?
And I just have to laugh here because you brought it up first this time, but we have so far mentioned Stephen King in every single we have to call his agent up and invite him on the podcast.
Well, maybe we should just actually like read a book. I've never read a whole book by him, so I don't know why this keeps happening.
I think he's had such a fundamental effect on the national dialogue in our country, and you know he's taken on issues in his books that are just very relevant to what we talk about.
This time it wasn't our fault. The movie brought it up.
But it does seem to be a recurring theme in our discussions.
I do want to talk about the therapist. I really only have one point to make about the therapist. I mean, we already talked about him a little bit. Like I said, I think he's the kind of therapist who just listens to what his clients say and doesn't push back at all, which I think a really good therapist should be a little bit better at understanding the fact that not everything your client says is the literal truth. But the line that he says that to me was just the biggest red flag ever is he looks at Sandra and says, he described your behavior as quite castrating. I'm sorry. Any man who describes a woman's behavior as quite castrating is just an embodiment of a red flag. One of the most like disgusting misogynist phrases out there. It's just there to call you a harpy, basically.
And it says everything you need to know about Samuel. She is castrating him. It is her fault that his life is so bad. It is always her fault.
She is castrating him by A, being more successful than he is, and B, not taking his shit. That's it. That's all she's doing. And he's describing that as castrating. Okay, so after hearing the recording of the fight and also hearing Sandra's lawyer make a good case for the potential that Samuel may have killed himself by basically painting him as this person that we have just been discussing, a man who is frustrated by his own failures and taking it out on her and then ultimately taking his own life, their son, Daniel, says that he would like to testify again. And then that kind of leads us into the end of the film. Some of it's a little weird, but he goes home and there's a woman who's been assigned to make sure that Sandra doesn't interfere with Daniel's testimony at all. And he basically asks her to kick Sandra out of the house for the weekend so that it can just be the two of them. And I think you're definitely supposed to think at this point that whatever Daniel's thinking is going to
tip the scales.
Yeah, it seems like he is more suspicious of his mother rather than less. But that turns out not to be the case. I think part of what is going on is he just needs to process what he has just heard, because ultimately he does have the final bit of proof that his father killed himself. Mm-hmm. Two pieces of proof, actually. The first being that, so the main piece of evidence that Sandra has that this may have been a suicide is that several months ago, she found Samuel lying in a pool of his own vomit, and in the vomit there were partially digested aspirin, and then she found a bunch of empty blister packs in their trash, and she thinks that may have been a suicide attempt. And that is part of what leads their son to do this bizarre experiment on their dog, because he suddenly,
scary too.
Yeah, terrifying, like kind of the most intense part of the movie. He remembers that around that time, their dog got really sick, and he thinks that it's probably because the dog ate some of the vomit. So he intentionally poisons the dog with aspirin to try to recreate these effects. The dog is fine. The dog survives.
Barely. It looks like he's dead at one point. And this is a well-trained acting dog, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's very intense. I was about to be like, ooh, this movie's going to lose all of its points if they kill off this dog.
No, and Messi, M-E-S-S-I, the dog, is a stellar actor, I just want to say.
Yeah, so the dog almost dies, but it turns out to be okay. Unsung hero of the movie, Marge, the woman who is assigned to stay with Daniel, she basically saves the dog. She, like, gets it to drink some salt water, which causes it to throw up, and then I
had no idea that would work, and I
raised two children. Interesting to know. But Daniel then testifies in front of the court about this happening and tells them that he almost killed his own dog, apparently. But then he also says, and to me, this is not only the final evidence that Samuel killed himself, but it's also kind of, for me personally, the final indictment of Samuel as a person, because how could you lay this on your kid like this? But when the dog got sick, Samuel took the dog and Daniel to the vet and gave Daniel this little speech about how he needs to prepare himself for the dog's death either way, because Daniel got upset and said that he didn't understand because the dog was pretty young. But Samuel says, well, it may be young, but it's a very good dog, and it does all of this stuff for you, and it spends all of its time taking care of you, and that can be exhausting. So it may die sooner than you think, and you just need to be ready to accept that. And Daniel says in the courtroom, I know now that he was talking about himself. And I'm just like, how dare you tell your kid that you're going to kill yourself and it's their fault? Because that is the subtext of what he said to his child.
Nothing is ever Samuel's fault.
Yeah.
It's his wife's fault, and then it's his child's fault. But here's the thing about Daniel in these few scenes at the end. Well, first of all, something, like you said, something clicks for him in the courtroom. Yeah. And he sends a message to the judge. And the judge leaves for a minute and comes back, and everybody's like, what's going on here? They don't say anything at first. We get through that court scene. The day is over. The trial is supposed to be over. But the judge says, no, we're reconvening on Monday morning so that we can hear new evidence from Daniel. Then they go home, and this happens. And Marge is her name, tells the mom, tells Sandra. He needs the weekend to himself. He doesn't want you here. Yeah. And this is heartbreaking.
Yes.
Because she is completely convinced that her husband has succeeded in turning her child against her. Yeah. That was heartbreaking for me because I had a similar experience with my ex-husband. I never worried about him turning you against me because you were older, but I was very worried about it with my son, with your brother. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting on pins and needles as I'm watching this scene. It is so real. They did it perfectly.
Yeah.
But as the good mother that she is, she pulls herself together and goes to a hotel.
Yeah.
And she doesn't insist, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk to my son. You know, someone who is guilty would not have done that. First, yeah. That's one big point about this.
Because she is more concerned with Daniel's well-being child than her own. Yes.
Yes. The second point is that Daniel becomes the adult in these series of scenes.
He does.
He does what these adults in the court cannot do. And that is to see his mother as someone who is not a victim, unlike mm-hmm. the way his father felt about himself. She's not a victim, except maybe of the court system at this point. She is not a murderer. He can see that. He can see the credibility in her that you and I have been able to see her in her, and that probably every woman who watches this movie can see in her, maybe and maybe a lot of the men, but not all men. So he becomes the adult that the story needs because it's not getting adulting from the prosecution team. Yeah. They are just acting like children because they want to win. We get to the final scene in the courtroom where he gives his testimony. And it's heartbreaking, but it is so beautiful. This young man is a great actor. Milo Mercado Greiner. He gives the performance of a lifetime, the kind of performance that adults would kill to give. And you can just see that he is wise beyond his years.
Yeah.
And, you know, and maybe that comes from his situation. You know, when you can't hear or you can't see, you have to make up for that lost sense, you know, with other senses. Your other senses become stronger. So in his case, he had perceptive abilities, I think, that he could hear in people's voices what's going on. He can listen. He was listening to that recording of his parents, and he knew what was going on. He could tell what was going on because he couldn't see them. He could hear it. He knows them well enough that he could hear what was going on, and that's what turned everything for him, although I think he never at any point thought his mother was guilty. But in there somewhere, I think it's the weekend when she's in the hotel, she's watching television, and there's a TV commentator who just talks about her as being this amoral woman who just doesn't have any feelings. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't cry.
And I think part of his evidence is that she's written characters who are like that, right?
Yes.
He's talking about the books that she's written as well.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's not that she's amoral.
No,
it's not that she doesn't have feelings. She is committed in a very real and loving way to both her husband and her child at every step of the way. She's committed to them, but she's also German. She's not going to sit there and cry every minute. She's got a classic German reserve, and yet at the same time is so very articulate. She doesn't let her emotions prevent her from articulating the truth to these people.
Yeah. This is also a classic woman trap, right?
Oh,
If she cried, she'd be hysterical. She doesn't cry, she's amoral.
Yeah, women can't win. But there's a point in this scene with Daniel, getting back to him, where the prosecutor, and this is, I had to laugh at this, the prosecutor tries to get Daniel to consider that his mother tried to poison his father rather than it being a suicide attempt, and asks him, why choose one speculation over the other? Because Daniel has chosen this, has chosen to believe this. And this is the point that the prosecutor's trying to get across. You chose to believe this. And Daniel comes back and says, I chose it based on the evidence.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because the prosecutor has been making statements throughout this entire trial that are purely subjective. And he says to Daniel, you're being subjective here. Really? Because you, Mr. Prosecutor, have been subjective during this entire trial, which, by the way, would not be allowed in an American courtroom. Thank you, American jurisprudence. Anyway, but it's so funny. It's so ironic. He can't see it, that he's been doing this during the entire trial, and he's accusing Daniel of doing what he has been doing.
I think it's a move of desperation, because I think he kind of knows that Daniel just destroyed his case.
The reason Daniel can destroy his case is because he's looking at the evidence, but he also lived with and loved both of his parents and knew them both very well. He's a perceptive kid. He knows what's been happening in this relationship, and he weighs the evidence against who he knew both of his parents to be.
I think when you first watch it, you think that he's spending that weekend trying to come to terms with who his mother is, but he's actually trying to come to terms with who he has known his father is this whole time, but hasn't really been able to accept.
Well, and it's a maturational issue.
Yes.
You might take information in as a 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old that you don't really understand.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the experience to understand it yet. But by 11, he's got enough experience, especially with the past year, with all, you know, the reporters and the investigators and everybody who's been in his face about this. He's grown up a lot.
Just to talk very briefly about the very end of the film, she gets acquitted and then she goes out for dinner with her lawyer. It's also a very well done scene, and it's kind of the ultimate heartbreak of the film because, as she says, she thought that winning would involve some kind of reward, but there is no reward and she doesn't feel any better. She says she doesn't even really feel relieved.
There's going to be recovery time for her and for her son. I was sitting there, as I often do at the end of a movie, trying to figure out what they're going to do. What path are they going to follow? So I'm thinking that she's going to get rid of that house and move him back to London.
Yeah.
And try to build a life for themselves in a city where she understands the language.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, but we don't really talk. We talked a little bit about, but she is required during the court scenes to speak whenever she
speaks.
In
French,
she's supposed to speak in French because it's a French courtroom. And at some point, she has to describe something. I can't remember what it is, but she turns to the judge and she said, I don't have the language to describe
this. It's too complicated,
It's too complicated. Can I speak in English? And they have an interpreter who interprets it for the courtroom. Language is very important in this movie.
Yeah.
Do you want to go into hot takes, or are we ready for that? Or
it's hard sometimes to come up with hot takes. I think my hot take is just that I do think this movie is too long. I think it's overall a good movie, but it did not need to be 2.5 hours long. I don't understand why so many movies these days are this long. I think you could cut out probably 45 minutes from the beginning and I don't think you'd lose that much. I'm sure some people would disagree, but I think the lead up to the core of this film goes on a bit long. That's my hottest take.
Well, and I have a couple of hot takes. I think her relationship, Sandra's relationship with her lawyer, who is called the maestro, by the way, and that means master. But anyway, their relationship goes back to when they were younger. One of them talks about being in love with the other one.
Yeah, the lawyer was in love with her. Yeah.
So they had a relationship when they were younger, and there is a connection between them. He's a little withdrawn at first because he has to be. He's her lawyer. But they get closer and closer. There's a scene where they're a little drunk, and you keep thinking that they're going to end up having sex. That doesn't happen. And at the end of the movie, they get very close to each other, but they don't kiss. And I'm sitting here thinking, an American movie would have them all over each other. This is perfect. It's much more heartbreaking to know that they had this connection earlier in their life. I don't know if the relationship with Samuel is what broke them apart, or if they just moved on by then, but Samuel does come between them time-wise.
I think regardless of how I feel about Samuel, she is still grieving him.
Absolutely she is. She's grieving the loss of her marriage, of her family, of that version of the family. She loved him. She really appreciates this Vincent. She appreciates him. She may even love him in some kind of way, and she definitely is affectionate to him in that last scene. It's beautifully filmed. They're sitting in a tavern, and the other people that were at the table have left, and they're just sitting there, and they kind of embrace, and then they go home. So my hot take is that they didn't make this into a romance, and good for them. So that's one thing. And she does end up, the only person she sleeps with in this movie is the dog at the end, and that's the last scene, and that's a very good scene.
I think she's in Samuel's office, because she's sleeping on a couch.
Oh, and yeah. She references, she doesn't go to her room.
That she referenced that she would sometimes join, he was sleeping in his office, and she would sometimes join him for the end of the night. I think that's where she is in the last scene.
So I didn't realize, I had written in my notes, what is the name of the movie mean? And I think we did come to a conclusion about that. Anatomy of a Fall. Well, there might be other theories out there about it, that the fall is the one she almost took. Because if the one he took, he is a physical fall, and then she almost took the legal fall for it. So I think that that's a
maybe also the anatomy of kind of the fall of his life, because we do, like for me, that the journey that I went on was going from thinking that this was an accident to thinking that it was a suicide. So I think a big part of what we are examining here is kind of how he spiraled out, basically, how he fell from a happy life to what he saw as a dead end.
And I think my final hot take is one that you and I talked about just a little bit last night. Tess and I try really hard not to talk about the movie before we talk about the movie. But she was really struggling with it last night, and she left me some messages saying, I don't know how I discuss this movie without coming across as a...
misandrist.
That's a word that was not in my vocabulary, and I had to look it up when she said that, which is like the misogynist, only the opposite. It's a woman who hates men. Yeah, it's really hard when you watch films or read books or see real life stories, this kind of a story, which is clearly the indictment and the trial all grow out of a need to convict this woman and to portray her. And maybe that the prosecutors aren't misogynists, we don't know, but they use their misogynistic tendencies to portray her as the evil, scheming woman who, you know, deserves to go to prison for the rest of her life, and because they can't see her as a human being that she is. She's just a bad, evil woman. And it's hard to watch those stories over and over again. So I think when you told me last night that you were worried about this, I just felt like, well, let it go, baby. Say it. You need to say it. Sometimes we have to get it off our chest. So.
Well, because I was thinking about how I feel like a lot of men watching this movie are probably going to feel a lot of sympathy for Samuel, and I started to hate him pretty early on in the process.
The music in the first scene made me hate him.
I felt like he was very clearly my idea of a nightmare person. And that just got stronger and stronger as things continued. But I also think that he is a real type of person. And I think that this film does get at a part of misogyny that sometimes some people don't seem to understand, or that we don't talk about very much, which is that a lot of misogynist men, the core of their misogyny is a feeling of their own failure. They feel like they have not achieved what they're supposed to have achieved, and meanwhile they're, you know, bombarded by constant pop culture messages about how cool and strong and how much better than women they inherently should be, and also that, you know, women should just love them and do stuff for them. Then, you know, they see the world as it is today, where a lot of women are just as successful, if not more successful, than men, and they interpret that as women have stolen success from me. And I think that that's a very common way of thinking. I think that pretty much all incels fall into that way of thinking. They feel like they have failed at life, and they've decided that that's women's fault instead of their own fault.
Well, and you said that you pretty much did not like Samuel all the way through the movie. I think that coalesces for me in the scene where we watch him trying to trip his wife up and getting her to admit that everything is her fault. This actor is really good.
He is really good.
He doesn't have much screen time. I mean, this is pretty much it, this scene, which is maybe 5-6 minutes. And he completely, it's a turning point in the film, because even if you think she's guilty, when you see him do this to her, it's hard not to realize that this is the bad guy in the movie. I hate to say it, because he is mentally ill, but he's the bad guy. So.
He is. And I also want to say that Sandra Hüller's performance is also incredible. Having rewatched, I mean, that whole scene is really good, and I do wonder how they managed to accomplish it, because it feels so naturalistic and so much like a real fight that it's hard to keep in mind, like, these are actors who memorize these lines, because it feels like it just flows.
Anyway, that, dear listeners, is all for today.
I'm Tessa Dare. You can find me at my website, tessadare.com, where you can sign up for my email list. Or you can follow me on Instagram at author.tess.adair or on TikTok at author.tess.adair. And you can follow us on Patreon at patreon.com/whereyoulead.
And I am Beth Von Baron. You can follow me on Instagram at STL_writer_Beth or sign up for my weekly Substack email, Saturday Morning Musings at STLWriterBeth.substack.com. This has been Woman Inherits the Earth, a mother-daughter podcast about women and film. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll tune in again in about 2 weeks. See you then.